This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I'm just about to talk to a favorite author, and I want to give a special shout out to my goddaughter, Kanisha, because I know Kanisha loves these books, and I just want to say I am so happy to have back on Joy on Paper, exactly 1 year later, Taylor Mejia. Hi, Taylor.
Hey, how are you?
Wow. Oh, the year's gone quickly.
It really has. I can't believe it's been a year.
I know. It doesn't seem like that long. And you are back with another big hit. As I wanted to say, my goddaughter, Kanisha, loves these books, and I love these books. This is a wonderful series, and you're a wonderful writer. And they are middle grade novels that are written with such intelligence that it's just, and so much charm that it's delightful to see what you're doing with this character, Paolo Santiago. And so tell us about the new book, which is, oh, wow, it's really exciting. This one is The Forest of Nightmares. Tell us about
yes,
this book.
It is. Yeah, so as you know, the last book, Pal was kind of forced to confront all her skepticism about myths and folklore as all these monsters came to life in her town, and she really found herself able to kind of meet those challenges and do a great job at, you know, rescuing her friend. But now, in book two, she's kind of back to her, like, more mundane, regular middle school life, and her mom's got this obnoxious new boyfriend. She's kind of growing apart from her best friends, and all in all, she would prefer to go back to monster hunting rather than deal with seventh grade. And then she starts to have these nightmares again, which kind of catalyzed her first journey in book one, but this time they're about her estranged father. And so the book, without giving too much away, is kind of about her pursuing that connection and figuring out a lot of the how and why of what happened to her in the last book.
Well, I love the characters. I love what you've done with it. And there's this realism to it, because there are, you know, a lot of children have mothers who, you know, get a new boyfriend, and you don't always, you know, really like him at the beginning, perhaps, or maybe even at the end. So I think that...
Yeah, no kidding.
So I think it relates, you know, to a lot of kids. If it's not their own life, they... can relate to their friends' lives. And then, of course, you have wonderful characters in Pau's friends, Dante and Emma. So tell us a little bit more about how you came out with this wonderful character in general. I just love her.
I'm so glad. Thank you so much. I just, you know, with Pau, I think we talked a little bit about this last year, but Pau was kind of me picturing what I thought my then 4-year-old daughter was going to grow up to be like. She's really space obsessed and really into science, and I'm kind of more like Pau's mom, really into folklore and superstition and tarot cards and stuff. So I was like, I wonder how that dynamic is going to play out. And then when it came to her friends, Dante, her next door neighbor, you know, they had in the first book kind of their little boy girl weirdness happening. And in this one, they've got some different challenges. Dante, I think, in a lot of ways, is more what you'd expect the hero of a kid's book to be like. You know, he's a boy, he plays sports, he's getting out there, and he starts to feel a little bit jealous of Pau and kind of the place she's found in this mythical world. And then Emma, who was mostly absent in the first book, she was being held prisoner in a creepy, magical is a lot more prevalent in this book. And Emma, if you read the first book, you know, is you know, she's a lot different than Pau. She's got a really privileged, wealthy family. She's white. She lives on the nice side of town. And so this book for her is about her kind of coming to terms with all the privilege that she has and, like, how she can help that, help her community with that privilege.
Well, you write it so beautifully. It's just, I love the intelligence behind it because, as you said, I mean, you can bring in science, you can make girls feel powerful because I as a child, as a girl, I was all science. Everything for me was science. That was, other than Latin, the only classes I liked were science classes and math classes.
Yeah.
So I relate to that. I want a girl to feel strong, and you've captured that. I think it's just delightful.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I feel like girls really do need to be encouraged more to stay interested in science and math, because I think a lot of girls at super young ages are into that stuff, but then as they get older, they're kind of discouraged from pursuing those fields. I know I was as a kid, so it's nice to see more effort put towards keeping girls in science.
I agree, and I think it can be inspirational. Your books can be inspirational. I think that there's so much goodness in your books. You're trying to get this across, that people can just be good to each other, and it makes all the difference.
Yeah. I mean, basically, if you could boil down the books into one thing, that would be it.
That's what I think. When I finished the first book, of course, I love the first book. And now I remember why I enjoy talking to you so much. You have the most delightful giggle. It's just adorable.
I have a lot of fun talking about these books, I guess.
Well, you do. And it comes across in your giggle. I think that's absolutely delightful. And I think that's perhaps why, when a woman can still giggle as sweetly as you do, it's perhaps why you can write a book for kids that really, I don't know, just has that feel in it, that you just fun, that it's a great read.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's what kids' books should be. I mean, you teach lessons and you want to get through to them on that level, and you want them to read and you want them to love science. But ultimately, the reason we read books as kids is because we want to have fun. We want to enjoy the characters and the adventures. So that always comes first.
Now, I don't have much time with you. I know you're really busy today, but just say something about Rick, because Rick has really put together this wonderful, wonderful group of authors to write these wonderful books. Tell us about Rick.
Yeah, Rick is amazing. You know, I was a big fan of his before I ever worked with him, obviously. I loved the Percy Jackson books, and those really got me into Greek mythology and folklore. And so working with him has just been a dream. He's such a pro. He's a fun guy. He has incredible stories, and he just is so knowledgeable about everything to do with children's literature. So it's been, like, honestly a dream to work with him.
Well, you're very lucky to be working with him. He is delightful. I love, well, before the pandemic, when he used to go to events and talk to kids, they treat him like a rock star. I mean, it's amazing, amazing. And he deserves it, because he's brought so much wonderful, work to children's books, and really wakening a love for reading in children. So I always want to give a special shout out to Rick. He is absolutely wonderful, and as are you. And I have a feeling I'll see you probably next August.
Next August, yeah, I'll look forward to it.
You're working on the third book, I assume. Okay?
I am, yep. Paula Santiago and the Sanctuary of Shadows, next summer.
Okay, well, you'll be back, and I again, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. I know you have to run, and everybody, get this book. If you know a kid in your life, get this book. It's called The Forest of Nightmares, and the second book in the Paula Santiago series, and Taylor, you are just fantastic.
Thank you. So are you. It's so great to talk to you.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye.
All right. I just love her. She's so sweet. Wow. What a wonderful story. And, you know, it all comes down a little bit of South America. So it is a nice lead into to my next guest, and this is almost, it's sort of overpowering. I have a lot of very important guests all the time, but wow, I don't know. Moses Naim is, I couldn't even start to read everything that he has done and everything that he is, but I can tell you, he's written his first novel, and I really enjoy it, and it's called Two Spies in Caracas. And it is about Venezuela in 1992, and I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Moises Naim. Hi, Moises.
Hi there. Delighted to be with you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, I don't know. I should call you. I should call you Dr. Naim or something.
No, please. No, don't do that.
Okay, because, I mean, you are really so important. You know, when somebody is called one of the world's leading thinkers, my goodness, you know, that's a sort of...
No, but what you have here is a novice, a novel writer and had never written fiction before. And so, you know, none of the other things apply here. It's a different experience and a different person.
Well, I tell you, I enjoy so much Two Spies in Caracas. It reminds me a little bit of one of my favorite authors from back in the 50s. She was very popular back in the 50s, Helen McGinnis. And she wrote this type of spy book, very always centered around some, you know, political event, some upheaval. And they're actually very gentle books. And in a way, this is a very gentle book because you have a love story and I love the characters, but then, whoa, the world is falling apart around them. And I think you did it, just explained it beautifully, drew us into the times. And I think it's also, every once in a while, a novel comes along that I think is really important. And this novel is important because I hope people will read it because so many Americans don't understand anything about South America, have no idea about Venezuela, and have no idea what happened there. And you've blended all that sort of background knowledge into the book so beautifully.
And if they read it, my American readers will discover that some of the things that are going on in the United States are not too far from what we have seen in the Venezuelan tragedy, which is a tragedy, right? It is used to be a very wealthy, underdeveloped country, and now is a completely destroyed society and fragmented and in great pain. I'm not suggesting that that's the path that the United States will take, but I do mention things that happened there that will have an echo with some of the things going on here.
Well, of course, in your brilliant book, nonfiction book, End of Power, you talk there about revolutions and about the different types of revolutions. And everything that happened in Venezuela, when you look at it, and it was for Americans who... First of all, we have this whole generation of young people who admire Che Guevara, and we have people still who admire admire Fidel Castro. They don't quite understand the impact of what happened in Venezuela and why it's so sad. Because the people are so wonderful, and they were trying. They wanted a good life, and they. It's hard to understand it, but I think the book helps to put some things in perspective.
Yeah, I hope so. I surely hope so. But I was very aware that this should not be a political screener. It should not be like an essay, an academic essay or journalistic.
Well, that's the beauty of it. I love that you've developed this characters, the two spies. I love the two spies. And everything centers around them and about really getting to know them. So tell us about the two main characters.
Well, she is a Mexican-American that became a United States citizen and joined the Marines. And was very, very well, her performance was extraordinary. And And eventually she ended up working for the CIA, and she was put in charge of Venezuela. This country was 2.5 hours from the United States, that has the largest reserves of oil in the world, and that was going to Guantanamo. And so she sent there because the United States was always very close to the government there, and no longer. There's a new president called Hugo Chavez that is supported by Fidel Castro, the dictator in Cuba. And together they've taken over the country, and again, it's an anti-American country now. And so she's sent there by her bosses in Langley at CIA to make sure that that can be contained, that the takeover of this country by an island in the Caribbean called Cuba, you know, is contained or at least limited. And the Cubans know this. The Cubans know that the United States will try to do this, and they send one of their best agents to try to neutralize the efforts of the CIA and the United States in limiting Cuba's domination of Venezuela. And so the story intertwines what is going on, the turmoil, as you said, that was going on around them. And these two spies that eventually meet each other, they have secret identities, and they don't know that they are arch rivals. And they start hanging out, and then things happen, both things on a large scale and the micro-human level.
Exactly, and things happen. And well, Christina Garza, right from the beginning, we just like her. You know, you write there about how her family came across the border, how they were illegals, and how her childhood was based on sort of hiding out from you know, being discovered. So we got a very human feeling for her. We just right away felt close to her, and then she joins. Of course, she becomes a Marine and a hero, and her path, you know, to becoming a spy for the CIA. I thought she was is beautifully drawn. I really liked the character, and I thought, whoa, I just enjoyed it so much. Just discovering her and following her along with her. And then, of course, the Ivan, you know, Americans pronounce it Ivan, or how do you pronounce
Ivan,
it?
Ivan, yeah, sure.
Ivan. Okay,
well, so in English is Ivan, of course, and in Spanish is Ivan. Ivan Rincón is his last name.
Exactly. So, again, a very interesting character. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, he is a royalty in Cuba. He is the son of a general that was with Fidel Castro in the mountains and eventually became a force that overthrew the dictator. It was a dictator called Fulgencio Batista. In the late 50s, they overthrow him, and they established this revolutionary government led by Fidel Castro that is in power still today. And the general, as he's called, has a son, and the son is Ivan. Ivan is, of course, trained and prepared to take over the family business, which is a metaphor for the fact that he goes to work for the intelligence services. The G2 is the name of their spy, or the equivalent to the CIA in Cuba. And he becomes one of the main operatives, and he operates internationally in different places and runs the huge risks. And at home there's these mixed feelings about him in the G2, in the spy agency, because yes, he's very effective, but he's very unruly, he's very disorganized, his loyalty and fealty to the revolution are not clear. He likes the good life and so on. And then he's sent to Venezuela to lead the efforts to contain the U.S. attempts to limit Hugo Chavez's expansion and the expansion of Cuban interests in Venezuela.
Well, I think both of the characters are really fascinating, and as right, you know, exactly as you would want in a love story, spy story. I thought they were great. And although, you know, you have a lot of history and a lot of politics in there, it's all done seamlessly. We never feel like we're, you know, we're being lectured to, because it's part of the story. And I just thought it flows so nicely. The entire story is fascinating. And I hope that really that more Americans will read this book, because I think it's a first step, perhaps, in understanding and thinking about South America as, you know, as more than that, the terrible news we hear on television all the time.
Yes, and the United States, this is, you know, the backyard of the United States, and the United States is very important for Latin America in a variety of ways. It has always been, has made mistakes, but has also been very helpful very often. Here at bottom is a love story, but also is the story of how to defend democracy in countries where democracy is being undermined from within, which is now a pattern that you see around the world. You know, that leaders that get elected in fair and free elections, but as soon as they get to power, they start undermining democracy and the checks and balances that are needed for democracy. You know, freedom of the media, the independence of the Supreme Court, the independence of Congress, and so on. And that is what happened in Venezuela. And this is the story of both, a very intense human relationship, very complex and surprising, and a lot of unexpected things happen to that relationship. But it's also, as you said at the beginning, this is as they fall in love, the world changes under their feet at great speed, and changing who they are, who they think they are, who they want to be.
And all based here in Venezuela, which it's so incomprehensible when you think of it. If you think about it logically, and you know that this country is so wealthy, and yet people are eating garbage in the street, it's so hard to get your mind around that.
Yeah, one of the things that it shows is the frailty of institutions. We all depend, we all hope that institutions are the guardrails of democracy and that limit human rights abuses and incompetence, corruption, and all that. But then the story, history shows us, and in the novel I give a glimpse of how frail are the institutions that are there to defend democracy, and how vigilant we as citizens need to be, and how active we need to be to protect. No, you know, this is not a matter of one or a name or another name, a leader or another leader. This is a matter of protecting the institutions that ensure that we live in freedom and democracy.
Wow. You know, I admire you so much. And as I said, your other book, the one that I think you're most famous for, End of Power. Again, this is a book that one reads and one thinks, my goodness, what's going on with the world? When are we going to sort of get it all, our act together? I just get so frustrated by everything. And partly it is because so many people don't want to pay attention. They don't want to know anything. And that's why we are now facing so many problems here, you know, in the United States. And it's a shame, because South America is such a wonderful place. It could be so great. And it's just very frustrating. And I hope that more people will, you know, we have to pay attention, and that's what it comes down to. And I think creating these characters, very, very relatable characters, will help people perhaps to start to take an interest in South America and also in democracy in general, as you say.
Yes, I hope so. We as you say, we live in very confusing times. There's so much going on. There's climate change, and there's a pandemic, and there's a political turmoil, and there's the international frictions and all that. So we are all even experts, are very confused. I'd like to quote, there is a Spanish philosopher that wrote in the 1930s, when Europe was in deep upheaval, He wrote, his name is José Ortega y Gasset. He's one of the leading Spanish philosophers, political thinkers. He wrote, "We don't know what is going on." And that is exactly what is going on, that we don't know where we are. And I think, you know, that was 1930s Europe, but as you, I'm sure you feel, that's very applicable to our lives today.
It is. It is. And, of course, when we have somebody like you, you have this enormous background, enormous, you know, you also the resources, because you know people and you know important people and you talk to important people. Are they all as confused?
Yes, you know, those that pretend to be to not be confused are probably the ones that are more confused. They're posturing about knowing it all and having being in control and understanding what's going on in practice is a big, you know, we are living in a world of charlatans these days. You know, there's a lot of people posturing and pretending to know what's going on, but it's, you know, the confusion has very strong roots and very strong reasons.
But in the end, for book lovers, a book is always something, a wonderful way to escape. You might learn something along the way, but in the end, it is a time to escape into a different world. And right now, strangely enough, in this pandemic-y world, Venezuela didn't look so bad. So you can get lost. You can get lost in this book, and just in the love story part alone will keep people turning the pages. I think it's beautifully written, as I said, and I really enjoyed it. And it's sort of, as I said, harkens back to the time when we wrote books that talked about political things without rubbing it in our faces. And just made the people, because we get to know Venezuelans too in this book. We get to understand them and we get to care about them. And that's very, very important. That's what an author has to do. And you've done it here. Moises Naim, I think, you know, I think it's a great novel. I really enjoyed it.
I'm immensely grateful, and coming for you from you, those words mean a lot. Thank you so much and for reading me, and thank you very much for your very, very kind and generous words.
Well, the name of the book is Two Spies in Caracas. It's a novel, and I hope it's there's another one coming along, because that's one of the things about when you start writing a novel, you enjoy it, and I'm sure that you have another novel in you. But Moises Naim, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper. The book is available, you know, wherever books are sold, and you can also follow Moises. You're on, I know you're on Twitter and Facebook, and it's on Facebook. It's Dr. Moises Naim, because you are a doctor and you're brilliant and one of the greatest thinkers in the world. I think that's a nice thing for people to say about you. Again, thank you for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you very much, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Okay.
All the best.
Well, you keep writing,
bye-bye.
And you'll be back. Okay. Bye-bye now.
Very kind. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay. Whoa. This has been I get these days where I just have one book after another that I really love. And now this, and now, you know, I was just talking about this book, Two Spies in Caracas. Now I get to calm down a little bit. Calm down, because I get to go from Hollywood to the Himalayas, the journey of healing and transformation. And this, I'm trying to get my inner calm, because I have to talk. I'm going to talk to somebody. I have to talk to her because I need some inner calm. And I hope I pronounce this right. Oh, goodness. Sadivi is the first name, right? Sadivi, are you there?
Yes, it's Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati.
Oh, let's do it again. Sad?
Sadhvi.
Sadhvi?
Bhagavati.
Bhagavati?
Saraswati.
Saraswati. Okay.
Perfect.
Great. All right. We are here. And whoa. And you have... This is an amazing book. As I said, I'm trying to find my inner calm, and I don't feel that calm anymore, or if I ever did, but I'm definitely not in the range that you get calm. But you've written a delightful book in so many ways, and of course you have Deepak Chopra saying right at the beginning. That's really nice when you get an endorsement from him. And then you have a foreword by Prince. How do we pronounce his name?
It's just Prince EA. He's a very, very famous, you know, multi-dozens of millions of followers, spoken word artist who takes the power of the spoken word for interchange and change in society. He's a dear friend and a beautiful spiritual brother.
Well, he wrote a beautiful foreword, Prince EA. Okay, I'm going to take a deep breath because I would like, there are points in this book as I'm reading the book, which is called Hollywood to the Himalayas, the part where we get to the Himalayas, where we learn some calmness, and you're in a place that's just, once when you're writing about it, it's obviously a love story because you're writing about a place that you love. And so tell us about Rishikesh and about the river that is now has taken over your life.
Wow. Well, you're right. It is a love story in many ways, but it's a love story of the vastest proportions, because it's not a love of form to form. You know, when we love another being, especially if that love isn't very deep, if we just fall in love, it tends to be form to form. Like, I'm attracted to you, my body, my intellect, my emotional package and patterns is attracted to you. So that's kind of a form to form, external to external love affair. And the experience that I was so incredibly blessed to have in India has been a 25-year love affair of what you could call not form to form, but content to content. So it's of the soul, of the essence, of the spirit. And I went there at the age of 25. I had graduated from Stanford University as an undergrad. I was then doing my PhD in psychology and really had everything that in this Western world we're told one needs in order to be happy, in order to have a successful life. I had come from great opportunity, great privilege, great education, great access to whatever I wanted. And that was fantastic. And yet I also really suffered very, very deeply. I had experienced great challenge and even trauma in childhood. And that had led me to deal with that in the way that so many of us do, which is a very well-intentioned but not very effective way of dealing with our pain through alcohol or drugs or food or sex or these days, you know, Facebook or whatever our hard or soft addictive tendencies might be. We engage in that to pull ourselves away from the discomfort of the present moment in our own minds. And that was really the situation that I was living in, where on the outside, everything was perfect. I had this wonderful background. I had this wonderful education. I was married to this wonderful man. Everything was just going perfectly. And yet I really suffered on the inside from a lot of what had happened in childhood and a lot of the ways that I was carrying that, the way that we all have different challenges and things that impact us throughout our lives. And I got to India with a backpack, knowing nothing about the country, but my husband was on a spiritual quest. And so I agreed to go to India. And And Rishikesh was the very first place we went. We opened up a 500-page Lonely Planet guidebook in Delhi, and I looked at it and said, Rishikesh. Now, Rishikesh is a beautiful spiritual paradise on the banks of the sacred Ganga River, what here people call the Ganges, in the lap of the Himalayas. And we got there, and I, standing on the banks of this sacred river, had such a powerful, powerful transformational experience, awakening, connection to the divine. It was just, it was spontaneous, it was unexpected, and it was extraordinary. And that really began, that was kind of the catalyst for me of the next 25 years of my life. And I've stayed there. I've been there for the last 25 years. I live on an ashram, which is a spiritual community called Paramarth Niketan. And it's the largest ashram in all of Rishikesh. And it's one of the largest spiritual institutions in all of India. And it literally means, the name Paramarth Niketan literally means an abode dedicated to the welfare of all. And we are very deeply focused on service of others, service of the poor, the needy, the sick, the environment, the rivers, the trees, the animals, service of all as the deepest and highest spiritual calling. Well, so it's been an extraordinary blessing.
Well, I love your writing.
Well, thank you.
You know, one where you start off and you're one of the parts where I sort of, I found myself just smiling because I thought it was so, just written so lovely. You go to the Chaiwala, and the Chaiwala makes you Nescafe. And it's so cute. I'm just trying to imagine it. And as you're waiting to see a spiritual leader who you're really not sure what's going to happen when you meet him. So tell us about that incident there. Tell us about the Chaiwala from that. I love that section.
Sure. So I have always been a coffee drinker.
Me too.
I got to India, especially to North India. In the South, they do what they call filter coffee, which is what we would consider just kind of normal coffee. But throughout most of the rest of India, they are tea drinkers. And coffee is Nescafe. And it's mixed into milk, and it's super yummy if you like, you know, what melted Häagen-Dazs coffee ice cream would taste like. It's, you know, lots of thick milk and sugar and kind of a sprinkling of coffee flavoring. So the dilemma for me, though, was that for me, coffee had always been medicinal. It was just sort of what I drank in the morning, and it got my day started. And this melted Häagen-Dazs coffee ice cream flavor experience was not catalyzing my day. And so I trained the local Chaiwala to put not just a sprinkling of Nescafe, but to actually give me several teaspoons of it. And it was always so funny because there's a big crowd gathering around the Chaiwala in the morning to get their cups of chai. And they would watch how much Nescafe this guy would pour into my milk, and everybody's eyes would widen. was I really going to drink this? And so, yeah, that was sort of a fun experience in the beginning, walking into the marketplace in the early morning at sunrise and getting my coffee and sitting on the banks of Ganga and just watching the flow of this sacred river who had already transformed my life. You know, one of the working titles of the book was River of Love. And so it's interesting that you speak about this as a love story, because that was, it was a, our favorite working title before we came up with Hollywood to the Himalayas.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. It just, that's what I just felt that, oh, you know, that gives me tingles, because that's how I felt about the book. I thought, this is really a love story of this, of finding this place that just touched your heart and opened your mind in ways that are quite amazing. And to see, you know, 25 years later, what you've done with this experience. And I know that, you know, you have, you write, when you write about, you know, finding inner calm or meditating, I was finding myself, you know, stop for a moment and be calm, you know, because I really appreciated that, those sections. And then, of course, the discovery of all that you have accomplished in these years, and that you are, you know, that you serve on the United Nations Advisory Council on Religion, and all of the things that you've done, the public speaking that you do, the work that you do to particularly bring forward, you know, the women's rights. It's so impressive.
Well, thank you. It's been really a great blessing to serve as a vehicle, a vessel, a tool for service. And whether that service is through actually giving education and women's empowerment programs to poor children and girls and women in the Himalayas, whether it's running orphanages, whether it's running disaster relief programs or healthcare programs or environmental programs on the ground, or whether it's being able to serve as a voice for that in places like the United Nations, or whether it's serving as that vehicle for spiritual change for people and spiritual healing for people who come from all over the world, and they come and they join us for our beautiful evening satsang, which is a spiritual question and answer time, and ask their questions, and I serve as this vessel through which the answers come.
Well,
all of that has just been such a beautiful blessing to serve in that way.
Of all the countries in the world, when you're in India, to talk about women's rights is something, you know, it's a big deal. Things have changed a lot in India. I was just talking to Moises Naim, and he's written about how many women, older Indian women, are getting divorced because they're finally getting control of their lives. So, you know, it's a daunting task to bring women's rights to India, where I know that still, and it's happening all the time, where they are doing gender selection. And do you find this all very challenging?
You know, life in general presents us with a lot of challenges. And working in India is certainly no different. There is absolutely, in many ways, a selection against the female in India, both from in utero up until their careers. Gender equality is definitely something that needs to be strengthened in India. But it's interesting because in the religious tradition, there's a lot of not just respect, but reverence for the divine feminine. It's a culture that actually worships the mother goddess very, very deeply, very ardently. So it's just more of a matter of, and this is certainly a big part of the work that we're doing, is bridging that which people worship and believe in their spiritual traditions and actually the way that they treat the women and the girls in their own lives.
Well, I tell you, the book is fascinating. It reads beautifully. It is, I suppose, in a way, it is a river of love. You start from the beginning of your life with the challenges, and I think that helps people who read the book, and they've had challenges in their lives, and they've had problems, and you suffered from bulimia and other, you know, just problems of that many young people, young women in this country experience. And what you've done with your life, it's so remarkable and it's so uplifting. And the book is beautifully, beautifully written. And also I love the way the production values, because they've included, which is very unusual in a book like this, they've included color photos, which I think also tell a story of your life and the privilege that the Hollywood part, and then the part there in Rishikesh, and where you found this enlightenment and the joy in your face. I'm so glad they included the color photos in this book, because to see your photos, you know, the name of this program is Joy on Paper. And so joy is an important word for me. So when I look at your face in these color photos, it is, I mean, anyone looking at it, the first word they think of is joy.
Well, I'm so glad, because that's certainly what I have experienced in the freedom. You know, you mentioned the bulimia, and that was one of my well-intentioned but very ineffective and unskillful and deeply harmful ways of trying to deal with the pain that I felt inside my own heart and inside my own mind. And food is a very easy way to do that. And as you say, it's something that a lot of women struggle with. And whether it's a matter of we eat to feel full, or whether it's a matter of we restrict in order to feel in control, in order to feel like we are managing ourselves in some way, there's so many different ways that food plays into pain and conflict and stress and suffering. And what I experienced in that joy that you see is really the joy of absolute freedom, of being able to no longer suffer, being able to let go and forgive of the pain that had led me into that situation and that had led me to turn to food to ease myself.
Well, I want to tell people this book, and it's beautifully, as I said, beautifully done, Hollywood to the Himalayas, and it includes these wonderful photos of you, and with everybody, I mean, Prince Charles and the Pope and, of course, the Dalai Lama and, of course, your Swami. And it is just to look at the photos is like pure joy. And I want to thank you so much for being on the program today. And it's Sadhvi.
That's perfect.
Okay, so Sadhvi, I think that's all people have to look up. It's Hollywood to the Himalayas and the Journey of Healing and Transformation. And Sadhvi is spelled S-A-D-H-V-I. Just type that in. It'll come up. And it's available where books are sold. And if Deepak Chopra says read it, you should read it. As I said, I would turn to these photos. As I was reading and I'd get to different parts, I'd turn back to the photos. And you lived in 25 years, a remarkable life. And I know that you're going to go on and do many wonderful things and help people. And I hope that people will get this book. And it's, as I said, beautifully done, Hollywood to the Himalayas. Sadhvi, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And yeah, I do hope that people will go online and, you know, check out Hollywood to the Himalayas. And the full name, of course, is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati. And I really, really look forward to people's thoughts and responses, how through the book my experiences and my learnings help you. Because, you know, as you began, finding that place of calm within ourselves is so difficult. And on my journey, I was given such beautiful lessons, both experiential lessons as well as actually lessons that were handed to me, as in, here is a lesson. And I share those in the book. And I have brought this out to not just share my fascinating adventure, but actually to help people understand that freedom can be theirs and that grace doesn't discriminate and that what I have found is available for everyone. So please, after you read it, let me know how you feel. There's actually a website, HollywoodToTheHimalayas.com. That's HollywoodToTheHimalayas.com. And if you go there, you can even download some free chapters and you can contact me and find out all the details of like where the book tour is going to be. And I just would really love to hear how it impacts you, your healing, your transformation.
Well, I hope everyone will get this book. I mean, we need to find some inner calm. Believe me, we do. And I'm not feeling very calm in my life right now, but I do. But I did appreciate when I get to certain sections, and just because the way you wrote and the way you would write about being calm, I calmed down. And I thought, yeah, that's pretty good. I'm it's starting to work on me. And so I really, really appreciate the book. And everybody go to the website, Hollywood to the Himalayas, and then contact Sadhvi and tell her if you about your feeling about the world. And again, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It has been a real, real joy to talk to you.
Wonderful to speak to you too. Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Have a beautiful day.
You too, bye. Oh, wow. What can I say? My goodness, what an exciting day. Anyway, Bill Larson will understand why I didn't do commercials today, and also Glenn Erickson. And by the way, when you talk about Bill Larson, remember intellectual property people, because look what's going to happen to Scarlett Johansson, because she didn't have a good lawyer, I'm telling you right now. She needed Bill Larson, because you need a good lawyer. You never know what is going to happen in this world. And intellectual property means property, something that is of value. And look what happened to that girl. And here she was. She's a major star. So anyway, what can I say? Just remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. If you're very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, a streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I'm hoping for Carol J. Perry. And, you know, I'm hoping also for Rita Moreau, our book buzz gal. Her book is released. You have to get it. It's Murder on Honky Tonk Row, and it was released on Sunday. Oh, wow, what an exciting day. Anyway, thank you, Big Ed in the control room. Thank you for everything. And I always thank him, and he's so busy, he's going to salute me. I'll salute him, because he's my hero, too. Everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful day. And get this, Hollywood to Himalayas. Go to the website. It's really great. And Two Spies in Caracas. Bye-bye now.
WTAN, Clearwater.
FM 106.1.
WDCF, Dade City.
FM 102.3.
WZHR, Zephyr Hills.
FM 104.3.
Listen.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Rocket Mortgage.
I'm Steve Kathan. Two major stories emerging from New York. New COVID measures in New York City, and the heat is turned up on the state's governor, Andrew Cuomo. New York Attorney.